Welcome to ID the Future. This is Sarah Chaffee. Today we have on the show with us Dr. Brian Miller, who earned a bachelor's degree in physics with a minor in engineering from MIT and a PhD in physics from Duke University. He is a technical consultant for IdeaShares, a virtual incubator dedicated to bringing innovation to the marketplace, and serves as research coordinator for the Center for Science and Culture at Discovery Institute. Today, he joins us to talk about Jeremy England's research. Thanks for coming on the show, Dr. Miller.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Several articles have come out about Jeremy England, who is a professor of biophysics at MIT. He is purported to have developed a new theory of life based on physics, and he has even been described as the next Charles Darwin. Would you describe Dr. England's research and why people are so excited about it?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. Jeremy England is a very well-known physicist from MIT who's been in the press a lot because he is studying what are called non-equilibrium systems. And a non-equilibrium system is simply a system that's being driven very strongly by some energy source or some other force. And what he's argued is that if you drive this system with some force, then the particles in the system will arrange themselves in such a way that they'll more efficiently pull energy out of the environment and then dissipate it or release it back into the environment. And what he's done is he's argued that this could be somewhat parallel to living systems, because what does life do? Life actually will process energy either from the sun or from chemicals and then use it to build up its systems and then release energy back into the system. So he's arguing, or others more appropriately have argued, that his research may help to explain the origin of life and evolution itself.
Would you give an example of what absorbing from and releasing energy into the environment might look like?
Sure. It certainly can sound kind of abstract when you read the technical papers. But a simple example would be like a pendulum, or a more common example would be like a swing. So imagine you go to the park and you bring your child to the park, and the child sits on a very long swing with a long rope attached to some tree branch or to some metal bar. And what happens is imagine that you're pushing the swing. Now, let's say that you push it every 5 seconds. So the way you push it isn't necessarily synchronized to how the swing naturally moves. So let's say normally the swing would move back and forth every 7 seconds, but you push it every 5 seconds. So what your pushes do is you're actually putting energy into the system, and it causes the child to swing up into the air. Now, what happens is when the child swings back, the energy that you put into it is released through friction. So as a swing moves through the air, it produces heat and that energy is lost to the environment. So that's a good example of what dissipation means. It's simply heat released back into the environment. Now, if you model the swing like after England's idea, the idea is that the length of that swing can change with time. So every time you push it, it might get a bit longer, a bit shorter. What happens eventually is that the length of the swing matches your push, so that the frequency, the natural frequency that the swing goes back and forth, matches the frequency in which you push it. So for instance, the child may come all the way back and you push it right at that moment. What that results in is that the child goes to the maximum height possible and then releases the maximum amount of energy through friction. So that's an example of that system adapting to your pushing to best access the energy. And that's sort of exactly the idea that England has, is that the same thing could happen with chemicals, that the chemicals could interact and arrange themselves in such a way to most efficiently access energy being put into the system, like light or a piston compressing it, and then most efficiently release that back into the environment.
And what relevance would such a process have to the origin of life or evolution?
Well, the idea is that if you look at the early Earth, you have some chemicals, perhaps some soup of nucleotides or lipids. And what happens, the idea, is that if you have energy being shined onto, let's say, the soup in a pond, the idea is that perhaps the chemicals will arrange themselves in such a way to most efficiently access the energy from the sun or from another source, and then most efficiently dissipate it. So the idea is that the chemicals could somehow self-organize into the first cell to even more efficiently access energy and release it. Also, it's been applied to the idea of evolution. So perhaps there's some way that some simple cell would self-organize in such a way to more efficiently process energy from the sun, such as developing photosynthesis.
I'm having a little bit of a difficulty connecting swinging pendulums to the origin of life or evolution.
Well, that's not surprising. And the reasons you're having difficulty is there really is no meaningful connection between England's research and the origin of life or evolution. In fact, even England himself, if you read his technical papers, describes what he does as simply, quote, a possible analogy to life and evolution. Now, the irony is, in truth, his research actually strongly works against all theories of the origin of life.
And why is that?
Well, what he has done is he's drawn on various theorems, fluctuation theorems about non-equilibrium systems. And what these theorems and this research has shown is that what happens is that if you've got some system and it's being driven by some energy source, you can talk about reactions and how irreversible certain reactions are. And what I mean by irreversible is I simply mean that chemicals tend to move in certain directions. Like if you've got a cell, it tends to break down into simple chemicals versus simple chemicals forming a cell. So the idea of a system going in one direction is irreversibility. And what these theorems do is they see the irreversibility of certain transitions is related to how much energy is being dissipated in the environment or how much heat is giving off, and it's related to the increase of entropy of your system. In other words, the more irreversible a system is, the more it tends to go in one direction, is related to how much entropy is increased both internally and through heat absorption. Now, the problem is, this is very problematic for the origin of life, because the origin of life requires simple chemicals to form into a cell where you're both decreasing in the internal entropy and you're absorbing energy. So what happens is the origin of life requires nature to do the exact opposite of what these theorems suggest nature should do.
Could England's research then be used to criticize most origin of life theories?
Yes, England's research does work against most origin of life theories. However, it doesn't technically disprove them. And here's why. The complexity is that if you look at the mathematical models underneath his research, what they do is they talk about reactions moving in one direction versus the processes moving in the reverse direction. So basically, everything is time reversed. Now, the challenge is when England thinks about these applied forces, an example would be like a cylinder that's compressing a system. In the reverse direction, you have to assume that that applied force operates backwards. So in the case of a cylinder, if it compresses in the forward direction, it has to decompress in the backwards direction. It's like time runs backwards. However, when you're talking about origin of life, it's very difficult to think about what the forces on the early Earth would look like running backwards. So if you have like a pond and energy is being put into that pond through sunlight, what does it mean for sunlight to move backwards? It's very difficult to talk about. However, despite that complexity, it doesn't really matter, because if you think about what happens on the early Earth, any chemical process will tend to move away from the state of life, because again, early cells would tend to break down. They wouldn't tend to come together. Now, if you start to think about these extra forces like sunlight or heat from a thermal vent, those extra energy sources actually increase the rate at which a cell would break down or complex chemicals would break down. Because complex chemicals, like let's say you've got a long chain of amino acids or a long chain of nucleotides, it's unstable compared to the individual molecules that are separate. It's actually a higher energy state. So what happens if you apply energy, it's much more likely to break those complex chemicals apart than to build them up. So those energy sources actually make the problem worse. So when you look at any practical scenario for origin of life, Jeremy's research or all our understanding of thermodynamics suggests that life is impossible to form without intelligent intervention.
What about the claim that his ideas would help explain evolution?
Well, again, the challenge is that you can't explain evolution in terms of molecules kind of self-organizing as they access energy from some external source. It doesn't make sense, because if you look at any realistic complex adaptation, what you need is large amounts of new information. So if you imagine an early cell and you think, what does it take for that cell to process energy from the sun? What it takes is a lot of complex molecules, a lot of enzymes, a lot of cellular structures, which are determined by the information which determines how all the atoms come together. And that's not a process that will self-organize. It has to have information from the beginning. In the same way, when you look at, let's say, more complex life, like, for instance, if photosynthesis in plants is very different if they're desert plants. They use a special system called a CAM system. And to go from normal photosynthesis to CAM photosynthesis, you have to create new structures, you have to create new metabolic pathways, and all that requires large amounts of information. So even though, let's say, the CAM system might be more efficient at accessing energy from the sun, nature can't anticipate that that system is more efficient because it won't come online, it won't give an advantage until multiple mutations have already taken place and multiple adjustments already take place. So nature can't look in the future, see that all these changes will produce something more efficient, and then guide those changes for a purposeful goal. Only intelligence can do that.
Well, thank you for coming on the show today, Dr. Miller.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
This has been Sarah Chaffee for ID the Future. Thank you for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org and idthefuture.com.